Tiny Talk, Episode 3. In this episode, how to ask a question, interview with Bill McKenty, and summer reading list. Welcome to Tiny Talk, a podcast about mushes and other text-based virtual worlds. I'm your host, Javelin, and this episode focuses on learning things with and about mush. The opening music came from a live recording that my wife and I made at the Cadugan Samaktan, an annual reenactment of the battle between Ferdinand Magellan and Lapu-Lapu on the island of Mactan in the province of Cebu, in the Philippines, from which I've just returned. First up, I want to say a few things about asking questions on mushes. These thoughts are directly based on Eric Raymond and Rick Moen's excellent essay, How to Ask Questions the Smart Way, which is linked in the show notes. That essay focuses on how to ask a hacker a question about software. And even if you don't agree with all of the details, and I don't, it's a very good read. I want to highlight a few parts of it that I think are particularly apt for mush players asking questions about a game, about mush coding, or about most anything else on a mush channel. Everything I'm going to say follows from two basic principles. They're principles of volunteerism. If you're paying for support, none of this is going to matter. For a statement of the first principle, I'll quote a part of the essay's introduction directly. The first thing to understand is that hackers actually like hard problems and good, thought-provoking questions about them. If we didn't, we wouldn't be here. If you give us an interesting question to chew on, we'll be grateful to you. Good questions are a stimulus and a gift. Good questions help us develop our understanding and often reveal problems we might not have noticed or thought about otherwise. Among hackers, good question is a strong and sincere compliment. The second principle is that a good question is one that, when it's asked and answered publicly, gives the community more benefit than the effort required to answer it. So, as Raymond and Moyen put it, you will earn an answer, if you earn it, by asking a substantial, interesting, and thought-provoking question, one that implicitly contributes to the experience of the community, rather than merely passively demanding knowledge from others. Now, of course, there are several good ways to contribute to the community. When you get your question answered, the first thing you can do is think about how you can share that answer with others. If everyone wrote up the questions they asked that were answered and made that publicly available, that would be a powerful resource. The PenMush Facomatic and the TinyMux Wiki are two good examples of this for technical matters. For things like role-playing game information, many mushes have their own wikis or forums. Another way to make your question serve the community, particularly if you're asking about code, is to take your answer, implement it, and then make the implementation freely available for others to use and adapt. By the way, these two principles also apply to giving a good answer. A good answer should also be thought-provoking and lead to higher-level understanding and synthesis, which sometimes means a good answer is showing the asker how they can work out the answer themselves. And a good answer should give the community more benefit than the effort that was required to ask the question. That's why I think, personally, it's better to ignore a question that you don't think is worth your time than to provide a flip, sarcastic, or intentionally wrong answer. Now, how a question is asked is important, too. It's important to be precise if you're asking about a problem, and to describe the steps you've taken so far to solve the problem yourself. I mean, you do try to solve the problem with the existing resources and help files and game websites and so forth before you ask a question, right? It's also important to focus on your goal and the problem you're having in reaching it. And as Raymond and Moen point out, there are two really poor ways to ask for help with code that are at opposite poles. At one end, claiming that you found a bug. So maybe you have, but are you really sure you want to imply that because something doesn't work for you, it must be broken? And at the other end, spending a lot of time disclaiming your own lack of knowledge and begging for help. This often comes off sounding like unwillingness to do your own legwork. In any case, the Raymond and Moen essay has a lot of other good advice for mush players, including suggestions for how to answer questions helpfully, and this is just a taste of it. I recommend it to everyone. Bill McKenty, who plays Boris on Mush, that's M star U star S star H, is an educator and instructional designer at Hunter College Campus Schools. In this interview, we talk about one of his earlier projects, teaching concepts in geometry to middle school students using a Star Trek Mush. So you were the designer and implementer of a project called Getting to Z, an approach to teaching three-dimensional Cartesian coordinates to 7th and 8th graders. Can you remind us what three-dimensional Cartesian coordinates are and how they're usually taught?
Or in other words, are you smarter than a 5th grader, right? The popular show that's on TV now. We traditionally learn in elementary school, 7th and 8th grade, 13 and 14-year-olds, about the X and the Y axis. Usually in 8th grade, the Z axis is introduced. And so instead of having a place where you're plotting a point in two dimensions, you now have the ability to plot a point in three dimensions. And this is sort of traditionally done by taking a piece of string and pulling it from the chalkboard out into the classroom and trying to explain to the kids what the Z axis is. But the short answer to your question is it's a representation of a point in two-dimensional space, usually referenced by X, Y, and that could be, for example, 3, 2, or would be, you know, on a two-dimensional grid. And the Z axis is simply X, Y, Z. So it would be 3, 2, 4, and you can go into the negative or positive, you know, you can go into negative or positive numbers as you see fit. Does that answer your question?
Oh, yeah. So how did you involve a mush in that learning process?
I had been mushing for about 3 years, I think, before I started to make this kind of slow connection between games and using games to teach. I was playing a Star Trek mush called Paradox. It's now closed, I'm afraid, but the essential part of playing that game is they had a hard-coded system called A-Space on it, and you flew a ship through textual space. There's no other way to say it. It was never graphically represented. For example, a little dot flying through a whole bunch of asterisks or colon signs, but rather you would type sort of a command to issue a sensor report, and that would show your position in three-dimensional space, much like we just talked about in X, Y, and Z. So the whole reason that I thought about mushes was because I already had some sort of the game already existed. The space system existed. It was well implemented. There, you know, ships. There was other players. There was empires. It was a whole world, and it dramatically reduced the amount of work that I would have had to do to get the kids into the game space.
So that may anticipate my next question, which was, you know, why Star Trek and not Star Wars or some other milieu?
This is actually kind of a funny story, Jav, because I had a I'm 37 years old, and I had a sort of a rich history with Star Wars and Star Trek, and I made the assumption that if we used a genre that the kids could relate to, that it would be even more exciting for them. So, for example, instead of going with a unique space theme like Brody's Other Space, that if they could sort of link into something that they already knew, it would be easier for them to immerse themselves into the game world. And this is an important part of learning with games, this whole immersion thing. Well, I was embarrassed when we went through character generation, which is a common part of a lot of mushes and text-based games out there. You sort of create a character, and one of them turned to me and said, you know, what does a Klingon look like? So I immediately rented a couple of Star Trek DVDs, and we watched those so they could get into it, and that really helped them. So I originally chose Star Trek because it was very accessible for them, and you know, I was surprised that there was actually kids don't watch Star Trek as much as they used to.
Yeah, I guess not. So the kids played on the mush and got to have some experiential opportunities with three-dimensional geometry. Did it work in terms of your learning objectives?
Yes and no. I started off with a small group of kids, and what I found is that half of them were able to very succinctly articulate where they were in three-dimensional space in relation to other three-dimensional objects. This is actually a very sophisticated level of understanding. So it wasn't simply, okay, if I give you a space, -9000, -25, -2000, can you tell me where you are in relationship to another point in space? But they were able to sort of explain how they would plot a course from one part of three-dimensional space to another part of three-dimensional space. I had two guys that just could not get their heads around it, and I don't know if we had more time, if they would be able to get it. Part of my thinking about this is that it's a sort of a developmental thing that some students, I think, just thinking in three dimensions is a cognitive shift, and I just don't know if they were there yet. They had a lot of fun. They were very engaged, but as far as walking away with specific learning objectives, they did not complete the task.
So do you expect to do this again?
I would love to do it again. Here's the thing. I chose games because kids get incredibly, incredibly motivated. And you can't discount that. One of the problems for me working in a public school is to get kids motivated and interested about learning. And when I was working at a public school in Massachusetts, that was a real problem. And games presented I'm not trying to overstate this, a seriously powerful tool for bringing kids into the learning like a learning space. I've since moved to a school in New York City it's a very highly sort of a high-end school, I guess, with very motivated students. So I would love to do this again, but when you're working with a group of kids that are already highly motivated, games don't often work as a good instructional tool.
That's really interesting, as I hadn't thought about that at all. You gave a mush lecture recently where you said computers and technology are about teaching and learning, not about computers and technology. I wondered if you wanted to say anything more about that.
The traditional role of technology in education has been, and I'm talking about primary school now, so that's grades K through 8 or ages, the kids are ages 6 to 14. The traditional role has been that kids go into a computer lab once a week and they learn how to use Microsoft Word, they learn how to use a web browser or something like that. And it is, in my opinion, it is the absolute opposite of what technology should be. So what should be happening is the kids should be using technology to strengthen what they are doing in their classes. So for example, instead of coming into the computer lab and working on Microsoft Word, perhaps the kids would be drawing, I don't know, parallelograms or taking a picture and opening up Photoshop Elements and tracing parallelograms in a picture, if that's what they're studying. So that technology is divorced from the curriculum is actually a bad thing. And the more technology is integrated into the curriculum, I think the stronger it becomes as a teaching tool. I mean, you can do stuff with technology that you can't do any other way. We have kids that are making a DVD for their pen pals in France, and they're showing their school. You have to use technology for that. There's no other way to do it. They'll be explaining the different parts of our school in French, and that'll kind of go on their way. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. Now, for our, I guess, our U.S. listeners, though, I have to ask, and how does one do all this stuff in light of, you know, the No Child Left Behind Act and all of the legislation at the federal level that at least my friends who are teachers in the K through 12 grades find typically very stifling?
In fact, it's tremendously stifling. there's an interesting opportunity space. Many schools hold technology at arm's length because they don't understand it. So the scenario that I described earlier where technology was divorced from what was happening in the classroom is very it's a very accurate sort of depiction. It's what it is. It's how it works. If we can show that technology is contributing to the children's learning in a meaningful way, then I think schools and administrators will look at it as a helpful or a beneficial thing to the primary learning process. So reading, writing, and arithmetic, those sort of the core element of learning at the primary level can be augmented with technology, but we need to show, and when I say we, I mean instructional designers, people in instructional and educational technology need to show them how technology can make a difference. So that NCLB, which is No Child Left Behind, is here, and that we are so data driven now, and you know, it really is the focus is on these standardized tests. It is a stifling thing, but in the realm of educational technology, I think there's a tremendous opportunity space because it's treated as a separate, distinct subject. I think we could really bring in meaningful learning opportunities, you know, in the schools.
So you'd have to demonstrate that it's not only going to get the kids to learn what you want to teach, but that it's going to do so in some way that is as efficient or more efficient than traditional methods.
Precisely. I mean, the most common way of teaching is to lecture to the kids or to you know, have a group discussion. I mean, we talked about parallelograms earlier, so maybe we should stick with that. If we have a fourth grade teacher who's teaching parallelograms, the teacher might draw some pictures on the board. The teacher might give them a worksheet to do. The teacher might put some things on the overhead projector. And hey, there's no doubt that the majority of the kids will understand what a parallelogram is. They'll be able to articulate the differences between a parallelogram and a rhombus, for example. So let's take a look at how we could use technology to make this a lot better. If we had the kids draw their own parallelograms, if we asked the kids to make up their own quiz for their peers using, you know, simple drawing tools in Word or Office, then I think then what we begin to see is a deeper understanding of what the kids are – what am I trying to say here? We're seeing a deeper understanding of parallelograms from the kids. It's not simply I can tell you what a parallelogram is in a basic way. I can show you how parallelograms are used on bridges. Like we could take a picture of a bridge and kind of outline all the parallelograms on it, or what's unique, what about the angles in a parallelogram, or something like that. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, this is where Bloom's taxonomy, for example,
comes
in.
This is precisely what I was thinking of. And so all of a sudden we're not talking about the very basic understandings, but we're talking about evaluation, we're talking about synthesis, and we're talking about analysis, which is it's just a much deeper level of understanding something. And a lot of these standardized tests work on essay questions. And so it's not simply a choose the best answer out of five choices, but be able to articulate what you know about something. And if you want to articulate what you know about something, you have to be able to use You have to be able to have a deeper understanding about it. You can't just know this is what a parallelogram is. You have to know its applications. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, and I want to thank you very much for talking to me today.
Ellen, it's a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for everything that you do, and I'm looking forward to listening to your podcasts.
Well, it's May. Summertime is nearly upon us, and I thought I'd share my summer reading list for Mush players and designers. Some of these are things I've read, and so you can assume that I'm recommending them, and some I haven't read yet, but I hope to read in the near future. First, the stuff for role players. As you may know, I think that live-action role-playing games, or LARPs, are much closer to what we do on role-playing mushes than tabletop role-playing games are. So my summer reading list for role players is the series of anthologies produced from the annual Nudepunked LARP conference. These books are available as free PDFs, although you can also order bound copies. I've read the books from 2003 to 2005 and plan to read the 2006 and 2007 books this summer. The 2007 book, which is titled Lifelike, has 30 articles. Here's a selection of some of them. Immersion Revisited, Role-Playing as Interpretation and Narrative. Technologies of Experience. Playing Beyond Facts, Immersion as a Transformation of Everydayness. Breaking the Invisible Rules, Borderline Role-Playing. What Was the Story About? Poetics for LARP in Practice. The Bigger, Better, More Problem and Thoughts on How to Solve It. Impact of Relationships on Games. Confessions of a School Teacher, Experience with Role-Playing in Education. And that's just a few. There's a bunch of really interesting articles in here. So you'll find a link to that in the show notes. For the game designers, four books here. Two I've read and two I plan to. The two I've read are Richard Bartle's Designing Virtual Worlds and Katie Salen and Eric Zimmerman's The Game Design Reader, A Rules of Play Anthology. I can't recommend these highly enough. Every MUD designer should read these, really. If you haven't read them, get them and read them. The two that I plan to read are the original Rules of Play Game Design Fundamentals book, which is also by Salen and Zimmerman, and Rafe Koster's A Theory of Fun for Game Design. Rafe Koster, for those who don't already know of him, was responsible for Ultima Online and Star Wars Galaxies, and has a ton of smart things to say about gaming and about what makes games fun. And sometimes when I'm deep in the details of designing a mechanic for a mush, you know, I find that I can focus too much on making the mechanic work as I want it to, but not enough on making the mechanic or the game as a whole really fun to play. And Rafe is one of my gurus for this. So I'm really looking forward to reading that one. I've also got the Encyclopedia of Fantastic Victoriana by Jess Nevins on my stack. This looks really cool as a source of inspiration, even if you're not planning to build a Victorian-era role-playing game. And if you are, I think it's probably necessary reading. What's on your summer reading list? Post a note or leave me a voice message and let me know, and I will let the people know about that on a future episode. One bit of news and notes today. Hot on the heels of our recent Teaching and Learning Festival, MUSH, MUSH, has scheduled an arts festival for the month of June and is looking for people who want to display, exhibit, perform, or discuss art during that month. You can read more at community.penmush.org or log in, mush.penmush.org, 4201, 4202 for SSL. And that's it for episode 3 of Tiny Talk. Music for this episode was provided by Vate from the Aeronautica y Otras Tecnologías album and jamendo.com. Show notes are at community.penmush.org. Look for the Tiny Talk icon on the right side of the screen. If you're downloading this directly from the web, you can also subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes Store or with your favorite podcatcher. Tiny Talk is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works License 3.0, so you're welcome to share it as is, as long as you don't sell it. If you have comments, mushing questions you'd like answered, news and notes, or suggestions for future shows, send email to tinytalk@javelin.penmush.org, or leave a voicemail, 206-666-5114, and let me know if it's okay to play it back on the show. Until next time, keep the text flowing.